And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. It's fantastic to have everyone here for our Saturday night broadcast, which is a special broadcast. And this is episode 40 of the X series, which tracks the X steganography through secrecy programs and through history. As usual, I'm joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And we're going to be taking your questions in the second half of the program. Of course, ask your questions at any point during the broadcast, all in caps, and she will track them, and we'll get into that during the second part. We're going to do some special questions tonight that have been coming up a lot around the series, and we're going to get some good answers going for you on those. Something very special about this episode, it is now the fifth episode where we track the enigmatic Hemingway, JFK, Bimini, Edgar Cayce, Atlantis connection, and the national security / mystery school deep state intrigue going on around the rising of Atlantis. And the entire Atlantis rising theme, we're going to find out tonight, has been ongoing here. And the, you know, the mystery schools originally let it out, I would say, during the 19th century, and then really doubled down with Edgar Cayce's work. But by the time we get into the 70s and the 80s, there are many movements to do this that are then suddenly shut down. And we're going to look at reasons why. And we're going to look at how this all consolidated into a huge discovery by a small company out of Canada named ADC, which had a very interesting oceanographer named Paulina Zelitsky. And her work is actually quite fascinating. And I want to say that she stands there at a breakthrough of changing history. However, because she did it under the auspices of the Cuban government, it's invited a whole lot of intrigue and a whole lot of sweeping under the carpet and a whole lot of media blackout on it, and a lot of government forces that aren't immediately obvious when you look at a subject like ancient archaeology. Olivia and I passed something to Olivia just before we started about a tomb that was discovered that's 4,400 years old in Egypt of a high priest. And, you know, that's that whole period of Cheops, Khufu, and this whole development of the Great Pyramid, technically in history. But we know it goes much further back, according to the mystery schools, as far back as 10,500 BC. And what's interesting when we look at the Giza Plateau is, as someone who's a student of the Edgar Cayce readings, one of the very interesting things that he said in relation to when they placed the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid there on the Giza Plateau, that they, at the time, in 10,500 BC, this group of Egyptians and Atlanteans, were doing their own archaeology. So the spot was already ancient and was known to be basically a very powerful center. So that's the kind of, I think, really fascinating thing that happens when we look at these. You know, there's many stages of how this information goes back in time. And of course, the most important thing we need to do is get beyond the ridiculous story that civilization, the cradle of civilization started over there in Sumeria about 6,000 years ago. That's just not something that should be, you know, given all the scientific information that we have, it should not be on the books. And also, largely, the history of Egypt, we have to keep in mind, was written, and this is always shocking, in the 18th century. Egyptology as a science, as a field, came into being there. And they didn't have any real scientific instruments to track anything. So that we should take that as kind of the foundation for the real Egyptian history seems absurd on the face. And there are many reasons why they want to keep that story where it is, because it's far more convenient for the powers controlling those monuments and those finds, one. But two, in terms of the larger story of human history, they have to keep you kind of segmented into this small channel of thinking about what really went down there in the past. And we're going to get into some of that tonight. We're going to introduce you to Egerton Sykes, who's a fascinating Atlantis researcher. He's no longer with us, but we are going to put his work on display here tonight for the first time on the Dark Journalist Show. I introduced him briefly last night. And we have a fantastic crowd already. I see Carly from Dimensions and Beyond is out there. It's great to see you, Carly. And one of the things I really want to put across tonight, as it is, you know, we're starting to get this history-changing moment that is coming up before us. And the fundamental change that I propose we're on the crest of the wave here is that involves the Hemingway family, in particular Ernest Hemingway, but also his brother and his extended family and grandchildren, many who are still active on this subject. And the political intrigue around Cuba having a much deeper geopolitical purpose than just what it appears to be on the surface. And three, the rising of Atlantis and how that is impacting the entire political situation on Earth for those who know. And for the vast majority of us, we don't. We're out of the loop. But what the mystery schools have done, they've given us a platform, a kind of an outline. They've put it out into the public. They've let this information into the broader public. And that information is starting to come to the surface, very much like the landmass off the East Coast of America. And that's what a lot of this intrigue is about. Of course, you're going to find Edgar Cayce's story of the Two-Eye Stones and the Atlantean and the clash between the Emilius group and the Belial group in the heart of this. And we're also going to find Rudolf Steiner's version of Ahriman and the destruction of Atlantis from the anthroposophical point of view in the very heart of this, along with the theosophical Blavatsky and her, you know, the various people over at Theosophy. Annie Besant and Ledbetter, C.W. Ledbetter, along with Blavatsky, provide us with one kind of broad version, and Theosophy gives us a really fascinating overview in The Secret Doctrine of what Atlantis was all about, along with some other lost cultures like Lemuria. But by the time we get to the Cayce work on Atlantis, which in earnest starts in the 1920s, he really opens it up. He sort of takes that picture that they've painted and really lets it out, which shows that the mystery schools were ready to let out a lot more about just how advanced and sophisticated Atlantis was. Of course, we have on the record quotes from Blavatsky and Besant talking about how they had advanced airships and all sorts of advanced technology. By the time you get to Cayce, that technology includes this Two-Eye Stone, which basically ran the world energetically. And it's a very important thing for us to get our heads wrapped around, especially as Cayce said, this information was emerging again through these three Hall of Records, one in Egypt, one in the sunken remnants of Atlantis, of what was called Poseidia in a temple off of Bimini, which is just about 30 some odd miles off of Florida. And then in the Yucatan, in a small pyramid, another Hall of Records. So this is where they were placed by these initiates in these mystery schools back at that time. And ever since this incredible disaster occurred, we've been looking at this tradition of mystery schools carrying this knowledge down and leaving it with the right people and having this impact on society without it getting into the wrong hands. This has been their great aim. Once in a while, it does get into the wrong hands. But I think what's good for us to keep in mind as we move forward in this information before I present it all is that the exsteganography forms something which is a long tradition of humanity. And so when I was discovering it, looking in government secrecy, the secrecy of government agencies, you know, say starting in the 40s and 50s all the way up to today, it didn't occur to me at first that it was going to have this component, this ancient mystery school component. And then when the two came together, I think we're looking at something truly earth-shattering because it gives us that, I like to refer back to the Rosetta Stone, which is something that was found by Napoleon and his groups when they were searching through Egypt. And of course, they did extensive excavations through Egypt. But this stone is quite interesting because before this, and this is 1799 now we're looking at, just right around that period, coming in to the 19th century, you know, we didn't really understand what Egypt was all about. And in a technical sense, it was really a building with a lot of pretty pictures on it. And so this whole thing about opening up the hieroglyphs could only happen because, as we can see on the stone, it had the Egyptian hieroglyphs up here. And it was the same declaration coming forward in three different languages. And luckily, we understood the version of the Egyptian that was on here that was more of a common use. And then, of course, the Greek. So without that, without the ability to translate those hieroglyphs as a result of this stone, we would really be completely blind. My suggestion, after all of this research, which is, it's opening up more and more, but all the research that's come forward on this X steganography is that the X is very much a moment like the Rosetta Stone, because now all of these things are starting to open. And I'm going to start with some of those. And I always say, Olivia, it's good to start with the TKO. Right? Mm-hmm. You might as well go for the first round TKO rather than the 12 round boxing win.
So what's the TKO?
There's so many tonight. I don't know where to start. I think the TKO resides right in Cuba. Of course, the upshot of all this is that there was discovered in 2001 off the coast of Cuba by Paulina Zelitsky and her company ADC, this entire city that was underwater at a sea level of 2,200 feet, which is very deep and hard to access. I've given the comparison of the Bimini Wall, which is more, we're talking more 20, 30 feet from the surface. That's because Atlantis is rising at that point. And Casey had identified the American psychic Sleeping Prophet Edgar Casey, who had done a series of readings on this. He identified Bimini as the spot where the first major vestige of Atlantis would rise. But he cited the whole area as Poseidia, which was a majority ruling center of this Amelius group before the final destruction of Atlantis, and formed really the largest island. So we're going to go into some history on Atlantis and also on Ignatius Donnelly, who's another figure who brought it forward. And this is the mystery schools working the political angle, tanking a congressman. He was a candidate for vice president also, and he had a lot of very interesting kind of political ideas that fit right in now. You know, he wanted to abolish central banks and things of this nature. So this guy really was hardcore. But let's start with this. This was found in 1938 originally, and this is what got the Cuba Atlantis part on the map. Now, these were found in a cave, and it's Punta del Este is the name of the cave. And we're going to find our Paulina Zelitsky in this cave later, but let's take a look at what they found here. Now, many of these inscriptions went back thousands of years. They actually tagged them somewhere in the vicinity of 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. The more that they looked at them, about 20 years later, they upgraded that estimate to even further back. So we're looking at these, and we've seen, of course, amazing cave drawings and things of this nature, which even scientific publications agree give us incredible astronomical information for groups that shouldn't have had it. You know, they regard people around 20,000-30,000 BC as barely able to do anything except hunt and gather. So it's quite unusual when we see this happen. But of course, we're going to see immediately the X steganography popping up here. And the reason that's important is whenever you get into this, whenever we look at something that's related to Atlantis and the destruction of that culture, the X steganography starts popping up. Whether you're looking at it astronomically, symbolically, it's a tradition that's been kept. This is something where it's just inescapable when you get back into these periods. The Book of the Dead has it thoroughly. And when we look at other aspects of history, the X steganography comes forward in the Mayan culture, in the Greek culture, in the Egyptian culture. We've seen, you know, instances of it in ancient Iran, ancient Germany. It is a universal symbol. And the symbol, the steganography that's being used there relates directly to this destruction that took place of Atlantis and how whatever the mechanism was for that destruction had to be guarded and handed down, because it was a mixed bag. Again, it was incredibly advanced technology, so it held great promise for humanity, but at the same time, it became too dangerous. And it introduced a quality of destruction besides just setting off volcanoes and inundating lands. Apparently, it threatened the very evolution of planet Earth. And this is the effect that I call in the program apothium. And apothium is something that pops up now when we hear about the UFO file cases, when people say, you know, I went through a wall when I was abducted, or when I came back, I'd only been gone for 1 minute, even though I was there for 3 days. And so it's time distortion. It's a reality distortion field. That is the very essence of apothium. And that is one of the biggest things that they're guarding against in that UFO file. And the X technology is part of that. So again, the X technology isn't just referring to something in ancient times. It's something that's rediscovered in our own time by people like scientist Nikola Tesla, who we know has a great link with a number of these things. And his work was studied by people who were working in the UFO file, like President Trump's uncle, John Trump. So we've got into this in the series, and I'm going to do a little bit of a recap on those episodes. But for now, I think I showed this one last night also, this by the Yucatan Hall of Records site. And again, this is the cosmic turtle with the X steganography on his back. And he's got the Orion belt here. So again, we get an astronomical reference for some of these at times. And we'll find directly, you know, the as above, so below thing. When you're looking at that steganography in the cosmos, suddenly it shows up on the ground and the way that they lay the pyramids out and all the rest of it. But the X is crucial, and is something that the more we get a handle on it, you know, that comparison to the Rosetta Stone, you'll see, I don't make lightly. It opens up a number of ancient doors and gives us an idea to a lot of modern secrecy. And I think that's a good way for us to start off tonight. But I do feel that this is powerful. I'm going to show it one more time, a different angle here. And this is a mighty cosmological spiral map. And of course, we have some very interesting images going on here on the side. And Olivia, I want you to take that one too. That spiral is just out of this world. Amazing. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was they were trying to teach us, we know it's a very complex symbol that they're trying to reach us with. Okay, now, what's interesting is who turns up at this cave shortly before finding the city off of Cuba. And this is quite interesting because I hope it's obvious that the work of Paulina Zelitsky, I respect so much. I think she's really moved things forward. I think there is a lot of secrecy around the work that she's doing, but I don't think that's her fault. I think that they actually are controlling the way she's doing these expeditions. So she's in a kind of a tricky position. She's not freelancing. I mean, these are international waters that are, you know, the part around Cuba is controlled by Cuba. And so they kind of control her actions and the things I imagine that she can say about it. You know, you talk about an NDA. Well, there you go. But here is Paulina in 2001, shortly before discovering the ruins, looking at those very same spirals in the cave, giving us an idea that she's starting to, you know, we have to remember something about Paulina Zelitsky. She's an oceanographer that's been off Cuba since 1968. So that's a long time. That's, you know, some 50 years, but by here about more like 30 years. And, she came there, as I've pointed out, basically the Soviet Union discovered her great talent in oceanography and moved her into this position. But at the time, they were saying, we want you to study ocean currents off the edge of Cuba. That's the official story about this. One of the things that Egerton Sykes, who's a British intelligence officer who was an Atlantis, or the Atlantis expert, as we get into it, and I'm going to show more about him tonight, one of the great things about him is that there's no facade. You know, there's no pretense around it. It's like, no, no, the Russians are after Atlantis. The U.S. is after Atlantis. The Chinese are after Atlantis. And the Cubans are after Atlantis. Got it?
That's what Sykes said?
Yes.
Okay.
And he goes more to it. He's like, Atlantis is part of our past, whether you want to believe it or not. This is his basic line. But this is what's happening, which is that the people who've gone into this and really explored it from a number of different levels. You know, the thing about Sykes is he was multilingual. He worked with the experts, being in intelligence, having gone through World War II. He assembled the right scientists to look at this. And he interacted with all those authors, and he went into those programs, and he was like, actually, the most advanced program looking for Atlantis is out of Russia. So, you know, we have to keep that in mind as we're going about this. This isn't like, wouldn't it be interesting if they were looking for ruins? They've had programs in places for years now. And it's what I referred to with Dr. Joseph Farrell as archaeological wars, when he was talking about how we had this looting of the Baghdad Museum during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Many of these things are really plotted out well in advance. Yeah, you have.
Where did Sykes get his funding?
Well,
Or is that unclear at this point?
He was a member of a number of different foundations, and they found him to be an incredible asset. We're going to go deep into his bio.
Do you think he was a member of a mystery school?
I do feel that there's mystery school influence on him. The thing is, he's so in touch with the subject. There's, you know, as we've discovered in looking at his material, this is somebody who wanted to see it happen on the ground. And when he talks to different institutes and people and groups that are looking for Atlantis, he's kind of like getting them off the bench and saying, like, you know, come on, let's get rolling on this. And he did a little bit of that even with the Casey Foundation, when they were playing with the idea of having him come over and give a speech. And, you know, it took them something like 10 years to have him come over from the UK to do this. And he said, you know, you're wasting the best years of my life, basically. Like, you guys could be on this. You're in America. There's so many Atlantis sites in America itself, you know. And he identified three major sites of Atlantis Egyptian influence in America. And interestingly enough, they're kind of diverse. But Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Massachusetts. Well, we made the list. It's mm-hmm. pretty good. But he even went into the fact that the tribes had maintained the name down through the Egyptian visitors and the Atlantean stragglers who came here. And he identified the Egyptian deities associated with the names. Quite interesting. And of course, we're going to do more on him. Zelitsky's research largely centers on the fact that she found a discovery off Cuba, and that forms a major foundation of what all of this is about. Because, you know, this becomes the question over and over again, which is, why do we have all these incredible, you know, what's the deal with the incredible secrecy around some of these things? You know, and the way you might want to think about it is if, you know, for you, those of you familiar with the UFO file and that kind of research, just imagine that a saucer went down in a certain part of the ocean and everyone knew it went there. So the Americans and the Russians and the Cubans. And each one would be staking out a position, maybe trying to bribe the other one, doing all these things behind the scenes. Now, with the rising of Atlantis, this has major implications. You know, people talk about UFO disclosure and the major implications around that. Fine. But when you get right down to it, the discovery of the Foundation culture and their advanced technology actually has the power to really revolutionize consciousness on the planet and has to be something that is controlled and contained. Remember, even the tradition of the mystery school over all this time was to keep that knowledge hidden through groups and to let it out to humanity over time, because it has to be done very carefully. Now, I want to say something about Cuba in particular, is that these ruins form such a part of the foundation and identification of their culture that here we can see those cave pictures on a stamp in Cuba from 1970. So getting a real idea that they're getting the hint on their heritage. Remember, it was only discovered in 1938. And what happened, one of the things that Sykes draws from for his journal, which is the Atlantis Journal, which I showed last night. I'll run across here again today. But there's an article in there about Atlantis in Cuba. And this is from 1951. So when we get to the discovery of the Atlantean ruins off of Cuba in 2001 with Paulina Zelitsky in ADC for Castro, we're getting something that's 50 years publicly in the works. That is, in 1951, the Cuban Archaeological Council knew that there was the connection to Atlantis with Cuba. And they said so and brought it forward in their papers. And then the Atlantis Journal, which is something that Sykes published, they published this article in 51 about it. So it's on the record. There's no disputing it now. This is the journal. I showed it last night. And the article is listed here. It's Cuba and Atlantis. It goes into some great detail. I'm going to read some of it tonight. And I'm also, I showed some of this yesterday, but I want to reboot a little bit. This is what Zelitsky, her imaging, is finding off Cuba here. These are the monuments, which largely look like roads and pyramids. She claimed sphinxes, and I'm going to read directly from her interview tonight. We're going to hear her voice in her own words, which is something always remarkable. You know, there's a lot of interpretation, but it's always nice to hear the actual quote. I do feel when I look at these ruins that it's a staggering find, and it completely uproots and upends history because of a major culture, a pyramid-making culture, and the type of advanced knowledge and tools that are involved with that culture sank to a depth of 2,200 feet in some ancient period of our past. That completely changes all of the history that we know. That's why Atlantis is, it's one of the reasons why Atlantis is such a hot potato. Atlantis Rising is a real hot potato. That's more of the graphic imaging. We always try to find more here, but this is kind of the interpretation of the submersible unit that they sent down, because it's so far down there that at 2,200 feet, you're not going to get normal divers to do anything. And again, a lot of researchers found it interesting that Zelitsky didn't make it. You know, it's like as soon as she goes to this cave, all of those ruins open up. It's quite unusual. Maybe that's it was just kismet, you know, but certainly it made some people wonder. Okay, I have read through Paulina's bios, and she put out volume 1 and volume 2 in 2013 when there was kind of a renaissance around what she was going to do, and she was on a few shows and it looked like, hey, here we go again, she's going to come out and she's going to do this, and for some reason another block and it didn't happen. Some of the things, some of the ruins that have been found on other parts of the Atlantic, like in Spain, harken back to this Atlantean culture. This one in particular, I think, which we did in the image for this show, certainly gives us some idea that something very special is going on with these older cultures. And of course, we know from Plato and from other sources and from the Mystery School descriptions that Atlantis, just to be clear, occupied the distance between the Gulf of Mexico on one side and the Mediterranean on the other. So it's that large landmass there that encompasses what is now the Atlantic Ocean. Now we have a little bit of it on our end of the spectrum with like Bimini and the Bahamas and Cuba, apparently. But on the other end, Spain and the UK, Ireland in particular, that has a major, that's a major vestige. And the Virgin Islands and the Azores, this is all Atlantis country. And there are many legends about the Sargasso Sea, which also let us know that it was, you know, the major impassable zone there in the Atlantic, because it was very much a large landmass that sank, but it was very hard to get across because it just became this kind of amalgamated earth development that never quite sank fully beneath the waves. Very, very interesting.
Can I throw something in here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Under the Radar says, I have a friend who worked on contract ship for U.S. Navy mapping seafloor.
Okay.
He tells some wild stories after a few drinks. If you want to share any of those stories that you've heard with us.
Yes, we'd like to hear them. Well, it's info@darkjournalist.com if you want any kind of confidentiality. I could appreciate that. I would love to look at those. And I've heard some of these stories at times from people who work at that depth, and it is fascinating. You know, sometimes people say you can see it with Google Earth and stuff, but nothing beats being on the ground. I would say, you know, that's really the way to go. But definitely we have the technology now to really get a look at this stuff. And this is why it's so exciting. There's a whole new past that we'll discover there. And we're going to discover that there's an entirely, let's say, embedded tradition throughout our society of these mystery schools guarding and holding this knowledge through time. And that there are other mystery schools, which they call left-hand schools, which have tried to manipulate that information and really give us this, you know, false version of what's going on. And this is quite a power struggle that goes on. And I want to introduce the idea of the mystery schools before we get too technical with everything else. And also the Hemingway info. We're going to bring all that through here tonight because there's something major coming up on all this that I want to get everyone ready for with this episode. And that's so we're really looking at a foundation here. I want to remind everyone that you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter. That's what keeps us in touch much better than any social media site will. You know, of course, we're on there on Twitter at Dark Journalist and at O Wings Girl, let's not forget. Mm-hmm. Olivia is so active on Twitter.
I have to say I'm fairly obsessed.
Way more active than I am. But hey, I do my best to keep up. The problem is with the social media platforms, we've seen them kick everyone off. Of course, the most high-level figure was Alex Jones. But it seemed very arbitrary because he'd been on there for years saying different things. And this is just, they got the word from the Bilderberg end of the spectrum. The Davos crowd said, we have to do something. And, you know, you can like or not like some of these groups that they banned, but the idea that they're going to ban them off of a major social media platform for what they're saying is entirely un-American. So, you know, there's a great tradition of free speech here and at different democracies around the world. And, you know, it's unacceptable. And I think that it's going to spell some real trouble for many of these groups. That makes it all the more important for you to sign up for the newsletter because that's a direct channel between us where you'll get all the information that we have coming up. So go ahead and make sure that you do that. And you'll know all the exciting things we have coming up for 2019. Programming note, which is this is the last live show of 2018. We may have some surprises for you between here and there, but the next show we're going to be coming back for you with will be January 1st. We're doing a special New Year's live broadcast. And we have some great surprises and interviews coming up with a top guest for January. So we're looking forward to doing all that with you. All right, the mystery schools and their involvement in Atlantis and what they're trying to tell us. Let's start with that. In anthroposophy, the Rudolf Steiner School try to give us the impact of Atlantis and how core it is to our development, basically, and how it's with that understanding of the different stages that society has gone through that we'll be able to face what is perhaps the most perilous, which is all about this facing off against a group called Ahriman, which is sometimes identified as a singular type individual, you know, this nemesis of humanity that wants to kind of embroil humanity in materialism, scientific materialism mostly. It's quite a powerful doctrine, and you know, Steiner was no fly-by-night researcher. This is a major scholar who really had incredible credentials in literature, in scientific discovery, philosophy. You know, this is somebody who gave us the Waldorf schools. This is someone who gave us that early childhood development philosophy of freedom. and gave us the biodynamic farming that we see is so prevalent in different farming communities, entirely innovative, and we're still catching up to him on spiritual science, and not to mention eurythmy, which is part of that dance that I was showing there. Steiner has a very unusual story, and he was contacted when he was very young by a master there was a master who was a gardener when he was a child, and this gardener would show him the kind of the history of plants and things like that, and give him the idea of their uses. But what was happening, Steiner realized later, is they were grooming him to be introduced to this mystery school. Gardner. And what he realized later was that he was setting him up for this meeting, which would happen down the road with this mystery school. And he had his own kind of large-scale realization. But I have to say, when it comes to this work, and you look at, Helena Blavatsky or Edgar Cayce, like, they're all so dynamic, the people involved. But I don't think anyone ever had the scholarly mind that Steiner had. That is, he was prolific, but he understood the great kind of Renaissance culture. And this, I think, is a major advantage in terms of his communication about it. So he certainly would be looked at as one of the best. But his basic core story, along with what Andy Besant was giving us about Atlantis, was that we were coming back into this period, this stage, where we were facing a number of the same things that we had that had happened in Atlantis. That is, that the culture grew too fast in its knowledge before its wisdom, and that it nearly destroyed itself and the world. But Steiner also describes the kind of ramifications of this now, which is that, you know, we have an opportunity to really learn from this and to face off against these armonic forces, which he had predicted very well. When you look at his main work, which is done largely between, say, 1903 and 1925, this is somebody who's giving us that hint that the internet is coming, that these world wars are coming, and that squelch humanity and the whole transhumanist movement is going to bring on this incarnation of Ahriman. So it's quite dramatic cosmology there, but I think the more that we study it, we're getting a deep message. And Steiner was telling us that the Atlanteans had advanced technology, and he is giving us their location there in the Atlantic Ocean and telling us that they were destroyed over a period of time, and what happened to those survivors and how they moved out and caused the flowering of culture and all these other places, but that it was largely the work of Ahriman that had caused the destruction of Atlantis and not natural disasters. That is, the Atlanteans had learned the technology to such a point where they set off these disasters. And this is a thread that you will see through Theosophy, Anthroposophy, and the Cayce readings. It's undeniable. So we have to think about that and the types of things that we're doing now with fracking and the kind of nuclear power and the different things that we have, and how this is a reboot of so many of the things that happened in the Atlantean period. Okay, so that gives us kind of a little bit of the mystery schools. One of the things I want to say about this episode is the setup for part of what I'm about to discuss is in the Tua Dedanen episode that we did on Labor Day. Actually, this was episode 25. And
God, it seems so long ago.
Isn't it funny how time flies? But I do feel like that episode gives us that foundation of this unusual group and the kind of Atlantis and Ireland aspect. So it's the what happens after Atlantis goes down part, beyond just the Egyptian or the Mayan section. It starts to deal with what happens there in the Atlantic and what the groups are about. And Tua Dedanen is a group that comes up over and over again. So there's something to be very, very aware of. And we'll probably take another look at them coming up in January. Now, let's get into my recent look at these the Hemingway mystery in relation to Atlantis Rising, because this is one of the core areas where we're presenting evidence which is just not available. And we're presenting it and putting it together and finding the conclusions that will give us the evidentiary support for the things that we're looking at. We were able to put it together and actually show Hemingway was a part of this search, and that much of the harassment that he got as a result, including and up to his own suicide, is a result of the fact that he was involved with this Atlantis search, and that his involvement with it and the Kennedys' involvement with it may indeed be the cause behind what they call these Kennedy and Hemingway curses. And we'll find a gigantic crisscross between these two families, although it's kept very tight in public. Okay, first things first, JFK Library unveils trove of Cuba documents. You'll find this over and over again, and of course, I've mentioned how I've been at the JFK Library looking at this Hemingway document exhibition, and it is something else. And as I've said in the past few episodes, most of it rotates and basically is around this story, a very, very unusual story of Ernest Hemingway having this vault in his villa in Cuba. And this is important because, you know, it's a kind of a forgotten chapter there in history, and it makes no sense. There's even a national security memo that's been declassified around it, which makes no sense. Why is his villa in Cuba such a big deal? Why is that vault in his house such a big deal? What is Ernest Hemingway doing in Cuba in the first place? Why is he spending all of his time in Cuba?
How long was he there?
Well, in Bimini, it's as far back as 1931. Mm-hmm. So he dies, you know, he just gets out of Cuba when he dies and goes to Idaho. So we're talking 30 years of involvement down there. And the reason he's down in Bimini, supposedly, is because he enjoys boxing so much. And there's this thing about a boxer, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And then they say, well, he loved fly fishing and all this kind of thing. But, you know, the fact that his mother, Grace Hemingway, was close to Edgar Cayce, who had made these readings and had given her a reading on the record, and had made these readings about Bimini being where Atlantis was rising. And then we find the Hemingways in Bimini, and we find Hemingway's brother Les founding New Atlantis and like buying lots of the Atlantic Ocean for when this rises. We start to get a much better idea for all the things that Ernest is doing down there, and it becomes a much more intriguing thing than just Ernest as spy, which I know comes up quite a bit. So let's take a look at what's reported. Now, these are mainstream articles. So if you hear somebody say, well, that's a wild theory that DJ has there about, you know, them taking the vault, it's already in. The Smithsonian talks about this. So it's already out there in public. How Marion Hemingway and JFK got Ernest Hemingway's legacy out of Cuba. It's on the record. There's no doubt about it that the vault became the important national security item in the early 60s, as soon as Ernest Hemingway had committed suicide, and that Mary Hemingway sought JFK's help to do this. Now, I won't say that the mainstream articles about the vault come to the same conclusions that I do, but there's no doubt that the vault existed and that Mary Hemingway, with national security help, was able to extract it from the Cuban government and smuggle it back to America in a shrimp boat. That's a fundamental, and that's something that we need to get our head wrapped around if we're going to understand the impact of Atlantis Rising on Hemingway and on the Hemingway family, and how important that is with their relationship with the Kennedys. So the article itself goes on and on about how Kennedy did a number of things behind the scenes. And I think if you watch the last few episodes, you get an idea. Of course, this is Finca Vigía, which is the site that they're talking about. And I'd say that when we think about this, we can think about it really as Hemingway's main headquarters for a number of years there in Cuba. And there's a lot of unusual stories about it anyway. But one of the most important is that this vault that Hemingway kept there You know, there's this idea when you look at some of the mainstream articles about this that, oh, it was so important because it contained some letters that Ernest Hemingway had, or it contained an early publication version that didn't get printed of The Sun Also Rises. It's much deeper than that. What it involves is that the work that had been taking place by Ernest Hemingway in the search for the rising of Atlantis was placed in the vault, and it created a national security incident because America wanted it, having known that that's what was in there. And the Cubans may have not been even aware of the contents, but they were guarding it because the Americans wanted it so bad. So it became quite an incident, which gets ricocheted through a number of media stories and different journalists' views and people's different takes on it, but nobody seems to know what it was. Even in this article here, we've got a letter from Ernest Hemingway's widow could solve Cuban farmhouse mystery. It's this thing that's just hung out there. No one knows why Hemingway's villa became this national security meeting moment with JFK and Attorney General Robert Kennedy and the director of the CIA and the CIA liaison to the Air Force, Brigadier General Ed Lansdale. That memo stands out there, and Kennedy historians, when they read it, they say, we have no idea what the operation is that they're talking about there. But later, of course, Kennedy sends Mary Hemingway over there to Cuba to obtain this. And when she goes to the house to get the contents of the vault, after Kennedy has assured her that a deal has been made, who does she find there coming down the stairs but Fidel Castro? So it's very, very unusual. The entire story is because, of course, we've got the Cuban Missile Crisis bringing the world to the brink of World War III. What was it that was really going on there? We've had a lot of little Latin American dictators. You know, we dealt with it before. Something very strange was happening. And what it was, as we'll find out more here, is that this is related directly to the Cuban Atlantis story. So it gives us a better idea. But later, what we find is that just like the Kennedys having a number of major mishaps, like JFK Jr. dying, the two Kennedy brothers getting assassinated, and so on, and Chappaquiddick and all the rest of it, there's pressure put on these people that comes from not only deep state forces, but this kind of mystery school face-off. And I think it's better if we're aware of it. Now, certain things may creep in, you know, people may add their own input to it, but I still think it's more worthwhile to understand what it's all about in the final analysis, so that the stories don't just hang out there and you wonder, you know, why did four Kennedys die in a row? What was it that they were dealing with? You know, and why is it that the society just moves on and doesn't have any of those answers? And, you know, once a year they do some special about how they were assassinated, and, you know, you have people come on and make these statements like, oh, isn't fate the fickle finger of fate and all that, which is, you know, ridiculous. PBS does a special and they're like, you know, they don't talk about JFK and the incredible things he was doing behind the scenes to wrest control back of the space program. You know, they talk about, you know, he may have had an emotional profile that was more isolated, which is why he was attracted to so many mistresses. You know, can we get a little
bit? It's always psychological.
It is. Yeah. And it's really, it's kind of fortune cookie psychology too. It's not the kind of depth that I think required here. So I am sounding off a little bit on the way this is done. Everyone, you're watching Dark Journalists. It's great to have you here for our Saturday night broadcast, of course, with Miss Olivia. And Olivia, how are the questions going?
Oh my God, I already have too many, of course.
We've
just begun.
We're going to do a major Q&A in the second part of the program. And asking your questions in caps helps us a great deal. But we do appreciate the quality of the questions. Everyone who watches the program knows that I call the chat there, the ideas room, because chat is just a dumb word for this, but because the ideas room is what's coming out over there. And I think it sets the standard for every other chat associated with a live video show. We have some of the best commenters on there. I see Rika, the hopeful volunteerist out there. It's good to see you.
We have
Rika.
A lot of people in the chat tonight that we haven't seen in a while.
Good.
It's really nice and really good energy tonight. I've noticed that, and I think everybody would agree, is that Friday night seems to be targeted now because that's our normal time slot. And Saturday, somehow, we're getting by. And it's sort of like the old vibe.
Okay, well, I'll take the getting by. That's good. I do feel like there is an interesting thing where everyone knows Friday night at 7 is when we usually do the show. And, you know, anything that we do in addition to that is always like, you know, it has this wild vibe because you don't know what's going to happen, just like tonight, trust me. Okay, but along that line of family pressure, I do want to point out Margot Hemingway, because when we get into her history, as we've touched on her a little bit, we've talked about that Hemingway curse, certainly her suicide after really following in her grandfather's footsteps and trying to understand what kind of pressure he was under, and after making really extraordinary comments publicly, and even working for a relative's psychic hotline, you know, there was something very, very unusual and strange, and I feel like something was coming out that she had really done a lot of research along this line, shall we say. I did introduce last night on the program Hillary Hemingway's book, which I have the copy of here, and Hillary Hemingway, being the daughter of Les Hemingway, who's the brother of Ernest Hemingway. This is the book, of course, and up here you can clearly see that is a UFO file. that's one of the craft there. And the book itself, which we'll find this link over and over again between the Hemingways and the Caseys, the book is dedicated to Edgar Casey. So, the acknowledgement is there in public from Hillary about Casey's impact on her work. Now, she's an author. She's done a few UFO books, and also, now I've found out, worked on some Star Trek episodes. This is quite interesting. Her husband writes the popular Showtime series Dexter. So, you know, she's done great in her own right, and she's also been involved in news production down there. But my point in bringing her out is this tie over again. Of course, her dad was the one who founded New Atlantis, so he knew all about this idea of Atlantis rising. But here we have, again, that Casey Atlantis connection coming up with the work of Hillary Hemingway. And one of the funny thing is that I couldn't help but notice is that one of the main characters is named Colonel Andros, and Andros is that island near Bimini where they have this thing called the Andros Platform, and that's supposed to be an anomaly, very much like the Bimini Road, which we're going to take a look at here also. So, yeah, she's giving us subtle hints. There's a funny thing in there about two fishermen who get abducted, and this motif of two fishermen. You know, I think a lot about either Ernest Hemingway and Edgar Casey, who are both known to fish, or Ernest Hemingway and his brother Les. I do think the Hemingway family is deeply involved, or has been in the past, in the search for Atlantis. And I think they've come in, especially as a result of the activities of Ernest Hemingway, they've come in for some incredible deep state scrutiny. But one of the things we're also going to look at tonight is the CIA background and the CIA words of praise for Jack Hemingway, who is Ernest's son. And I find their entries on him in their own files quite enlightening and unusual. Let's take a quick look at the Bimini Wall. That's the wall there. This is what Casey predicted would rise in 1968. J. Manson Valentine was a diver, found it, was flying over Bimini, saw it. And suddenly, the Bimini Wall became visible. It had never been visible before. So Casey had said it was the Temple of Poseidon where the Hall of Records had been hidden. So there's been a lot of hubbub about the Bimini Wall. And what's quite unusual is there was actually a disaster, a hurricane off of Bimini in 1926. And it was the position of the Casey Foundation that part of the Bimini Road had been removed at that time, which is very interesting because it supposedly wasn't even visible yet. So the rationale for that is quite interesting. I guess the real upshot of the whole thing with the Bimini road or the Bimini Wall is that it's giving us this tie over with what the mystery schools were telling us about Atlantis rising and how that's going to impact the culture. For when this land rises off the east coast of America, it's going to send shockwaves through every type of institution that we have. And if it rises containing ruins from a former culture, as we've seen with the Bimini Road and with Paulina Zelitsky's find, then we know we're in deep. then we're going deeper than ever. So we have to know that this is the period that we're in. And what's so funny to me is that as we've been doing this work around Atlantis, it seems this year is a prelude to so much coming out about Atlantis. And we see it even in popular culture and things like the Aquaman movie, which comes out, is coming up. That has a whole Atlantis theme. And
Bo Krills just saw that, by the way.
Oh, did he really? So it's already out.
Okay. I don't know how it is. Let us know.
Yes, tell us all about it. I remember the comic book as a kid. But what was it that Casey was trying to tell us here? What were we getting from Edgar Casey's Bimini readings? He was trying to tell us that an advanced civilization that was advanced spiritually fell apart because it had two factions, the Amelius faction, followers of one, and the Belial faction, the Ahrimonic faction. The Amelius group used the technology to interface with higher spiritual beings. They would get information from, quote, the outer spheres and the beings in the outer spheres. And the Belial group basically used it and used the incredible power of, death rays and the laser ability of this to dominate the landmass. And they became more and more materialistic in that sense. And that at a certain point, as a result of this, that great continent split into three islands. And that the island of Poseidia became the island predominantly of the Amelius group fighting this dominant group. Now, what's funny is the Belial group would saturate the Amelius group so that at a certain point, the Amelius group had to take themselves back as initiates and keep themselves separate from the Belial group. And we see so many echoes of this in the Bible and in these other cultures where this group is staying aside from everyone else and saying, you know, we have to move this information into these secret channels. And you see later with a lot of the schools like the Essenes and with these different mystery school traditions, that there's this idea that we're going to maintain this knowledge and we're going to keep it purified, basically. Because apparently at the time, the Belial groups had really polluted the spiritual stream of the information. Okay. One of the interesting things that Zelitsky found down there is quite unusual, and you can't make much of it here, but I wanted to show it anyway because I showed the ruins. But a lot of people have made this comparison of this face underwater. And it is hard to see, but it's one of these, you know, it's almost like the face on Mars type thing. There's a lot of anomalies in her visual work around this. And I think this could be part of the problem and the mystery, that if you have these developed cities and you have these faces carved and these sphinxes and stuff, there's just no denying it. You can't say, well, it's an anomaly like the media has tried to pass off since her original find has been discovered. And announced, they've been saying, well, maybe that was just some stuff from the Cold War and missile silos and stuff. It was just an anomaly. And, you know, the theme that they drove home in article after article was anomaly or no, Atlantis or anomaly. And I found that quite amusing because you could see it was coming down from the top of whoever was controlling the media saying, let's use this headline whenever we address this particular thing. So they have a big problem, the people who are trying to protect the secret, which is so much of it is out. The reason it's out is because the mystery schools guaranteed us a place at the table by telling us about it as far back as the 19th century. And, I mean, certainly earlier with people like Sir Francis Bacon, but in terms of a truly broad push into society, let's look at one of those broad pushes, and it is when Ignatius Donnelly wrote this book, which is Atlantis, the antediluvian world, we can see here that this version, published in the 1950s, says edited by Egerton Sykes, and it's a modern revised edition. Now, Sykes became such a well-known Atlantis scholar that everybody wanted him to do his work. So Atlantis, the antediluvian world, which was Ignatius Donnelly's masterpiece on Atlantis from the 19th century, that's not something you give the foreword to just anybody. He has to be somebody who's really well-reputed within the whole community. So this is the person that they gave it to. Now, Donnelly himself is a very unusual figure. There in Minnesota, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, comes out in 1882 and definitely shakes things up. He goes into how the languages are similar with these cultures, the Maya and the Egyptian, and he basically puts a lot of this on display for the first time. But what's happened before that is that the Theosophical Society has come out with information regarding Atlantis. But this wave that's coming up there in the 19th century, being pushed through mystical figures like Blavatsky and Steiner, being pushed through political figures like Ignatius Donnelly, we have to ask ourselves, where is that coming from? And again, we go back to that mystery school influence, because they want us to have the ability to fight this kind of large-scale misinformation scheme about our past, one. And two, I think it's also important to remember with the mystery schools that they want to give us the tools without directly interfering. So that's a tricky line to walk very often. One of the things that I remind everyone about when it comes to the mystery schools is that Rudolf Steiner had said, look, in 1840, they made a decision. Scientific materialism was taking over. It's coming out of Germany, scientific circles largely. But it was going to reduce everything to what could be measured physically, which is a disaster for the evolution of humanity. And Steiner said they came into a clash where some groups wanted to let information out to the public regarding Atlantis, regarding subjects like reincarnation, psychic development, the real origins of humanity. And also those who wanted to hold back and said, you know what, we've been holding these secrets. We'll continue to help humanity from the sidelines, but we're not worried about it. But there's certain enlightened group within those mystery schools, according to Steiner, C.G. Harrison, and some others, decided, well, this is serious, because in 100 years, humanity, we're not even going to be able to recognize humanity. There'll be no helping them. So we have to let this information out. And they did. And apparently it was just a small percentage of the mystery schools that started this. And when they let it out, it was pretty rocky road, frankly. Spiritualism exploded out of this movement. And the spiritualism became trivial. It became almost like a board game, like a Ouija board game. So the knowledge was kicked in there that there was this other world, but it became a trivialization. And one of the things that came out of that is the mystery schools withdrew from that effort and the people who were doing it. And the people of that period, like the Fox sisters and the Poughkeepsie Seer, Andrew Jackson Davis, they are the representatives of this push and this movement, because the mystery schools had looked out and said, we can use some of these people to try this out with, because they either have the right past life ability and training, or there's something about them and their spiritual psychic function that we can use. Now, we know from Emma Britton, who came forward and told us about the Orphic Circle, that these groups that were in London at the time were spotlighting and looking for these young adults that they could use in these psychic programs in order to find state secrets. They would turn them into somnambulists and get information on, you know, the nature of reality and all sorts of metaphysical occult questions, but they could also use them for political questions. So this is kind of an important thing for us to keep in mind, that when we get into this side of it, and we're thinking about what the mystery schools are doing, this is something that goes on in these groups and something that we don't see in public, because it's a great ability that humanity has to be able to tap these powers so that if they can trivialize it in popular culture, if they can make the psychic aspect, the reincarnation aspect, the spiritual aspect more of, you know, seem like something that is completely impractical and not real, then they basically take away your only ability to get out of, get away from being under their thumb. So I think this is the kind of way we have to look at how these things are portrayed to us and how we need to reinterpret what intuitive ability is, what psychic ability is. So when we are doing this aspect of the X-Steganography series, we're looking at it and we're saying, you need psychic archaeology. You need intuitive viewing in order to understand what the mystery schools are. And you need to understand, if you're going to understand the deep state, you have to understand what the mystery schools are. So you cannot trust it to just political analysis. You can't trust it to just financial analysis. If we had a great guest on right now who was a master of the Federal Reserve, we'd learn so much about history and how the money works. That's important. It's a major function. But you need all the pieces. If you don't have the mystery school forces and that understanding behind why this drives the deep state battles, then you'll never really understand what's going on behind the scenes. Just like we'll be in the dark when it comes to this Atlantis Rising thing, if we don't get behind the evidence that's out there, if we don't understand the forces that were pushing public figures like the Hemingways and the Kennedys around on this issue. So a lot of these things, when we see the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we see the battle over Cuba, the insane battle to get power over Cuba, and how so much of that is driven by this deep state covert wing and these invisible powers, you know, that we can't even get our hands on. We start to get an idea that it's deeper than just geopolitical interests. They're fighting for survival and they're fighting for dominance. And if we don't understand things like Atlantis Rising or the UFO file, I might as well just throw that in there, right? We're so far out on a limb. If we don't understand these things, then we're not understanding the elements that are causing the wars, the elements that are causing the stress, the elements that are causing the manipulation and the secrecy, most importantly. So we can get the transparency by apprehending these things that are available to us. So that's a good thing to keep in mind as we go into this next section. And as I go there, Miss Olivia, I'm going to turn to you.
My third eye is opening like crazy listening to you. Okay.
That's good. Well, this is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully that's, you know, goes further, I'm sure I'm not further the only than this one. Studio.
Okay, so wondering, okay, Lone Wolf wants to know, did Casey ever mention UFOs in his readings?
Yes, I mean, you have to understand that the Casey died in January 1945. So the major UFO wave hadn't happened yet, unfortunately. But there are references there to these priestesses that were trained, these Mayan priestesses who were trained to deal with those who were visiting from other worlds. So there's the off-world civilization part appearing in the Casey readings. Also, I do believe that when he mentions that the Atlanteans are dealing with people and beings from the outer spheres, you know, there's a reference to spiritual beings and beings in the spiritual world. But sometimes I think that this reference gets us directly into that off-world civilizations. You know, as I've said before, the off-world civilizations have a major role in visiting us, but they're more like, it's like a peer situation. And very often it's portrayed as this, you know, kind of godlike situation. And I think that programs like Ancient Aliens have really dumbed down the culture, and they've just looked at everything. I always make this excuse, but like, you know, whenever they show a guy with something round on his head, they're like, look, it's an astronaut helmet, you know? And it's that kind of dumbing down and trivializing of deep subjects that I think is actually very problematic and sloppy reporting. And really, I think it's the equivalent of clickbait, you know, it's just something for a headline. So it's funny too, because you'd want a show out there to inform the public about the off-world civilizations or Atlantis or something. But what they do is they turn it into this kind of game, you know, and they they kind of turn it into a, what's the next wild thing we can talk about? And I think I remember somebody pointed out to me that they were doing an episode about cowboys and aliens after this movie. What was the movie that was it? Breakback Mountain that was held at the time?
I have no idea.
Something. But anyway, you know, they'll ride any old trend that's going on there. So we have to be careful of that. Remember, when we get around these topics, the junk conspiracy is thick. It's actually thicker than the real stuff. And the real stuff has a very hard angle to get through. And the junk conspiracy has such a hardcore base because they've got the marketing, they have the money interests, they have the attack poodles to go out and do the sniping and all the rest of it. So having dealt with some of those groups over time, I have a better idea exactly how the junk conspiracy is a business. And so what we're doing here, and the thing, the place I think that we can get to in 2019, working on very deep subjects like what we're working on tonight, is to really limit the amount of attention we give to junk conspiracy. You know, there was this big conspiracy recently about JFK Jr. Now, this came out of the Q camp. JFK Jr. is Q and is going to, you know, come back from the dead, basically. He never died. He faked his death. It's like the Elvis afterlife, you know. When you find people talking like that, literally, I mean, you know, there's just nothing to say because very much like Flat Earth, those things are designed and put in there so that we don't get the kind of laser-like intensity and focus that we get in the type of research that we're doing here on the Dark Journalist Show. And happen, you know, it happens in other places, of course. And I repeat over and over again, we have the resources available through the work of the Solari Report, through the work of Dr. Joseph Farrell, Forbidden Knowledge TV, all of these different media resources are available now. And so there really isn't a good excuse for dancing galactic ambassadors and, you know, that whole thing. I think we're kind of past that stage. Let's see if we can do something.
Yeah, it seems like a test.
That's a good way to put it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is always a test when it comes down to it. You know, are you ready, basically? Are you ready to apprehend this material and see it for what it is? This is a very interesting point, I think, that we've come to.
Yeah, it was like a practice of discernment, which, you know, is valuable. And I think a lot of people have come through it wiser, a little more cynical.
Well, what's amazing to me, talking about the Gaia circus stuff with the blue chickens and all that, is how many people come up to me now who, like, 2 years ago didn't understand and were like, wow, you know, you really, those shows and the research that you did really helped with that. I'm glad, you know. And what's interesting is, I think there's always a ton of stuff out there and people are always going to be into weird things. And that's just the way it is. Often I don't pay attention to it unless those groups become hostile or monopolistic or plagiaristic. And then you have no choice as a journalist but to protect the interests of the public in that regard. Very, very interesting thing that happens there. Okay, everyone, you're watching Dark Journalist. Wow, it's a fantastic crowd tonight.
Can I ask you one more question about Casey? Okay, so absolutely. David Donaway says, predicted that the so-called Battle of Armageddon, described symbolically in the Bible, would begin in 1999. Casey foresaw that this battle would not be a war fought on Earth.
Yeah, actually, the way Casey described it is quite unusual. He said it would be fought between the souls that were leaving Earth and coming to Earth. You have to understand that Casey, when he speaks, talks on a very deep cosmological level. And he also speaks on a very practical, physical. He can speak geology better than anyone on the planet. And he can also speak medical. You know, he can give people dietary advice or you know, how to treat diabetes. And, you know, he can look at the body that way. But when he's speaking about things that are in the cosmology, like Armageddon and things like that, it's not very well understood because we just think of Armageddon as, like, you know, basically at this point, sending off our nukes and sending off nuclear Armageddon. But Armageddon's a very, very interesting concept. And I think what Casey was trying to get at is we have to look at it's a spiritual war. And that's spiritual warfare that they're discussing there. And then that spiritual warfare bleeds over into what we see here in our physical reality. It is quite something. You could spend literally years studying the Casey readings, and it's this incredible body of work that's been left behind. I don't think there's anything quite like it, actually, to come from just one person, you know. And of course, Steiner's work and Blavatsky's work, I would say the same about. Just, it's extraordinary. We certainly have their legacy, and the question is, how are we utilizing that legacy? And I think the question in the alternative independent media space, the alternative research space, is for the general person, you know, what are you moving toward? What are you supporting? So if somebody runs around after a fun headline or something like that, whatever. But, you know, when it gets right down to it, we've been given this great legacy by these mystery schools. And are we embracing that legacy and being serious about what they've given us? Or are we content to do the Elvis afterlife routine with JFK Jr. still alive and things like that, and Flat Earth and Dead Ends, which are probably programmed directly in there by intel agencies? I've studied those trends, and that's exactly what it seems like to me. As a matter of fact, I've seen some imitation X steganography type stuff, which is absurd and beyond absurd. And you can see that they're positioning now. But what's tricky is, having come through 40 episodes of the X series now, too much of it is out there to really get it off the boards now. So it's something that we can use. And it's something that I think is very interactive with us and the people who are out there, you guys watching, because you've got a lot of deep knowledge and deep experience. And now that you have the X steganography working for you, then we're all kind of working on this together. And I think that that gives us incredible resources from each other. And that's the way I look at it.
And I just wanted to say, because you kind of threw Ancient Aliens under the bus a little bit, that the first two seasons were spectacular. And I think they hold up over time. They were amazing. It's just that over time they were...
TV is problematic. I'm going to tell you, here's my Ancient Aliens story. You want it? Here it is. It's not pretty. I gave Ancient Aliens, because they contacted me, the story about Douglas Caddy and the scoop that I had with Douglas Caddy relating to him saying that Spymaster E. Howard Hunt had given the reason for the Kennedy assassination being the UFO file. And I told them the players involved, and I worked with the producer, who was this lovely woman, and she had all these great things to say and all the rest of it. And then, you know, I told her, you know, they wanted me to come down there and shoot. And I told her I was very interested in that, and that I could offer them material about it and help them produce it, you know, so that it would be more complete, basically. But something in that exchange there, I think, freaked them out. And they were like, oh, this guy wants to produce it, you know. And what they wound up doing was taking all that information I had given them, doing the show without me, and basically disappearing, running, scurrying away into the woods. So that's what I think about television, is I think that they kind of vacuum up the organic ideas that are here. You know, they'll manipulate people. We know that
they dangle lots of carrots.
Yeah, and Ancient Aliens doesn't pay the guests. That's absurd.
They pay nothing.
That's unbelievable. Now, you know, the people who are regulars in the show, certainly, but I guess they figure it's, you know, something that they can get away with because it's television. But hey, that's the way I think of television. I think of the arena that we're in is a lot more real, you know, and it's something where it's a visceral exchange of ideas between us. Whereas I think, you know, television is very often, can they get Ford Motor Car? Can they get the latest, like, Toyota commercial? It's a different reality. Yeah, I've been around those worlds before, and I understand them enough, but I prefer this one, put it to you that way. Okay, fantastic. Now we're rolling. So with your questions, we'll take questions in about a half hour. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
In the meantime, let's get into the Cuba health mystery and Egerton Sykes. Okay. First off, AP article. We've seen many of these. So, you know, this is one of many. Now, this is all about those diplomats who went down to Cuba, because what happened is Obama did one thing that wasn't heralded a whole lot before he left. It was very unusual and poorly handled. But he actually opened an American embassy in Cuba because Castro had passed away and they wanted this new relationship. And, you know, it was sometime very late in his administration and they did it and they kind of botched the rollout. I mean, it should have been more historic. There was something very, very strange about it all. So as it turned out, as soon as we opened the embassy and we send our diplomats down there, the diplomats start coming back with a very unusual health problems, you know, migraines, stomach problems. And now what's coming out is that the diplomats had inner ear damage almost from the time that they showed up. So this is a certain category of subtle weaponry that's being used against these people. Now, what I found that was interesting is a lot of the diplomats came down with CIA agents. And this maybe is something that somebody somewhere was objecting to, realizing the CIA was down there and they were going to infiltrate the scene. My feeling is they're going to infiltrate this whole thing about the Atlantis ruins rising. But I'm going to read a little bit of this. American diplomats affected by mysterious health incidents in Cuba showed damage in the inner ear shortly after they complained of weird noises and sensations, according to their earliest medical exams published Wednesday. The detailed findings were published in a medical journal nearly 2 years after what the U.S. calls health attacks, quote, began, and they shed no new light on what caused it, who did it, or why it was done. Quote, Dr. Michael Hoffer, University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. We don't know any of those things, what caused it, who did it, why it was done. They don't know. So they don't know the weaponry that was used or who was using it. Officially, on the record, the U.S. says, late 2016, 26 people associated with the embassy in Havana suffered problems that include dizziness, ear pain, ringing, cognitive problems such as difficulty thinking. Cognitive problems. A health mystery that has damaged U.S.-Cuba relations. Cuba has adamantly denied any involvement. The Miami researchers examined 25 of those people who reported hearing a piercing noise or experiencing a sensation of pressure before their symptoms began. The patients failed a variety of tests that detect inner ear problems associated with balance, what's called the vestibular system. I'm going to read a little more of this. Testing of 10 other people who were in the same building at the time of the incident found they were fine. So these individuals were targeted directly, and whatever that they were using, if somebody else was in the same vicinity, it didn't affect them the same way. Quite unusual. The inner ear balance problems have been central to the government's ongoing health investigation, and earlier this year, a team of doctors at the University of Pennsylvania, who also examined many of those patients, but months later reported they suffered a concussion-like brain injury despite no blow to the head. So you're a diplomat, you're down there, you get these inner ear problems, and now you have a concussion even though you've never been hit. So this is a very unique weapon that's being used to get these people out. Obviously, they don't want the Americans there. Now, the Cubans say, we're not doing it. Why would we do it? We let you guys down here. We opened the embassy. So who's doing it? Well, the search for Atlantis, I think, and the fact that the Cuban city is off Atlantis plays a big role in this. Because those diplomats, when they open up these channels again, will introduce American role and possibly American money into this, which may have been part of the issue for why it's been dangling out here now for 15 years. That there may be a financial aspect and there may be a group that wants to get their hands on it that has big money on our side. On the other side, in Cuba, it's a smaller family-based group, probably in the Castro family, that is protecting the situation because they want it for themselves and they don't know the full ramifications of it. And then we have this great history of Russia being involved in trying to get Atlantis and being, according to Sykes, the most active and the most knowledgeable. So this is quite a chess game playing out there, and I have no doubt that what's going on with the diplomats is related to it. We're going to watch that end of the story very closely. Okay, let's get into Sykes a little bit here. Miss Olivia, how are we doing over there?
Doing great.
Fantastic. Of course, last night I introduced Hillary Hemingway, who is Ernest Hemingway's niece, and her books, Dream Child, and I have the other one handy, but they are actually quite interesting and about alien abduction, and they are dedicated to Edgar Cayce. Egerton Sykes, I think what a lot of people are going to find about this guy is that what he has in common with all this is quite interesting. Let me get something specific on him. Basically, Sykes is one of these guys who was in British intelligence, and the subject followed him around his whole life. He just had this great interest in Atlantis. And he made it a point to kind of assemble the very best people and assemble the best library and the best notes and research around Atlantis, and then to support groups that were actively searching underwater for it. Now, there's a fantastic unknown story that goes back to the early 70s. And this is about a project he was helping out also, which is quite remarkable. Let's get a look at Sykes. This is Sykes with one of the women who was involved in this. And she had gone and seen ruins off of Spain and also off of Ireland. And she was an advanced archaeologist. And here is Sykes here in the middle, standing with her and his wife. But we're going to get into this story. I want to show you a little bit about this to let everyone know that the Atlantis part and this battle over these ruins has been going on for a long time, and there's quite a trail in the media, if you know where to look, for sure. Let's take a look at some of this. This is very interesting. This is the woman, and it is Maxine Asher. She put out a book called The Atlantis Conspiracy there in 73, but she had found in her research, by sending these teams down, they had found ruins off of Spain. This is a picture of the article, if you can get some of that in there. But she's quite an interesting character, and her relationship with Sykes becomes very interesting as I start to see her as Sykes' proxy. And again, Egerton Sykes being this advanced Atlantis expert, and they use these terms like Atlantologist and stuff. You know, I don't think we have the right name, the right term for an Atlantis expert yet. We're going to have to create that right here on the show. But what it says here in the Irish Times is pictures of Atlantis will be released in 6 weeks, American states in Cork. So she had the pictures and all the rest of it. What happened is the site itself got shut down and her materials got stolen. So she felt it was very aggressive activity on the part of the Spanish government. And she went further and further into this and became enraged and wrote this book about it called The Atlantis Conspiracy. Here are other articles featuring Egerton Sykes in the media. This one's out of a Miami newspaper. And let's read a little bit of it. The title is Britain Not Alone in Atlantis Hunt. Okay, it's from October 8th, 1965, even previous to the one we were just looking at, by Jeffrey C. Warren. Egerton Sykes is not alone in his quest for knowledge of Atlantis, the lost continent. The Russians have published a dozen authoritative studies on the subject over the past 20 years. Okay, that's 46 to 66. And recently, top scientists in the Soviet Union discussed Atlantis over a 42-station television hookup, basically their version of a satellite-wide broadcast to talk about Atlantis. This is in the 60s. There's a growing interest elsewhere in the mysterious continent, and Sykes, an Englishman, believes there will be much more interest in coming years. He points out that archaeological diggings have taken man back to various cultures back 8,000 BC at least. Sykes believes the destruction of Atlantis took place around 10,000 BC. Therefore, he thinks it's only a matter of time until archaeologists discover greater evidence of the existence of Atlantis. The Lost Continent is not a new subject for the 72-year-old Sykes. He had an interest in it since childhood, a hobby at first, and the study later became his livelihood. He looks the stereotypical British scholar, tall and slender, and so on. Quote from Sykes, "If you want to know something about me," he says, "I'm 72 years old. I've been in two world wars. I've been an unwilling participant in five revolutions. And my wife and I have lived in 28 countries. He was the best of the brass for the British intelligence at the time. This is a guy who knows quite a lot. But when he retired, quote unquote, he went off into this Atlantis trek, which had been his goal. And he had founded this Atlantis Journal there in the 40s and 50s. And that journal was around for 30 years or so. And it contains this incredible information about Cuba and Atlantis. Okay. For years, Sykes was with the British Diplomatic Service and then became a foreign correspondent for a London newspaper. When he retired, he was instrumental in organizing three societies and a publishing house in England dealing with Atlantis and kindred subjects. By the way, one of those kindred subjects was extrasensory perception, which he had in abundance, according to those who knew him. So this is a psychic individual working in intelligence, retiring, and then moving off into this Atlantis quest. By the way, there's a series of articles that I've found of his writing about the UFO file. So this is somebody who's very, very clued in. There are more articles about him. This is an interesting shot I wanted to show of him later in life there at a library. What I think that he amassed and what I think his gift is to us is that the search for Atlantis that's going on in Russia throughout the Atlantic, it was very active by the Nazis. They were searching for Atlantis. This was going to be kind of like a Nazi homeland. They were finding the original kind of space that spawned the Aryan race. But I think with Atlantis, what he's trying to tell us is that Sykes is saying, look, these other countries are involved in this. So if we're going to get our hands on it, it's a competition. You can't lay back and just do research. So, you know, he's one of the most well-researched guys, but he wanted action on the ground, which is why he was involved with some of these societies. One of those societies involved this woman that I just showed, Maxine Asher, who wrote The Atlantis Conspiracy. And that society in the search for Atlantis became a very active group. And they, you know, when they went into Spain and did these underwater dives, and when they went to Ireland and did these dives, they received incredible pushback by the governments involved, and they were eventually thrown out. This is what happened to a lot of these groups looking for Atlantis in the 70s and 80s. If you look, you can see that there are these books, there are these groups, and everybody's looking for it. By the time you get to the 90s, you have good researchers maybe doing quality books about our history, maybe like a Graham Hancock or whatever. And, you know, Graham Hancock did a number of individual independent dives and things, but you do not have the group support and you do not have the focus in the media around this at all. It breaks off completely. And you're left with independent researchers who just can do the best that they can do. And you have some good guys out there, but basically, for example, the Casey Foundation, you know, they have Greg and Laura Little, and they're great. They do a great job, but they, you know, it's a gigantic task. It needs basically an entire international foundation to look into it with resources and dives and permissions and all the rest of it. And what we've got in the Atlantis Rising camp is a bunch of independent people doing the best that they can, getting this and getting that. Meanwhile, whoever is controlling the ruins off Cuba and the Zelitsky story and all the things that happened there, they're getting closer to these finds. And I found that there's an entire program studying, this is great too, studying the marine geology around Bimini. That's a NASA program. That's a definite cover for trying to find the Poseidia temple that Casey talked about. So I think it's a lot better for us if we get real about these things and say, this is what's happening. Atlantis is rising. The mystery schools gave us that. They gave it to us through individuals like Steiner. They gave it to us through individuals like Edgar Cayce and his great legacy, which even the ARE is afraid to kind of pursue in a sense. So, you know, it's something where I think on our own, if we get a better understanding of what's happening here, then we get the ability to move on. Now, I'm going to cite a few things from the work of Andrew Collins, who does a lot of work around the idea of Cuba as Atlantis. But I think we're starting to get the picture here. Before I go into Collins, I want to read something directly from one of Sykes' lectures. And I think it's important for us to hear directly from Sykes about this. And right after that, we're going to hear directly from Zelitsky. So it's going to be really hardcore here. You're watching the Dark Journalist Show, and it's great to have so many people here tonight. Miss Olivia, as usual, doing a great job. We're going to take your questions here in about 15 minutes. And how are we doing with that?
I got too many.
Well, too many is better than not enough. Exactly. That's the way I look at it. But are you getting things along the Atlantis line?
Oh, absolutely.
Good. Everyone, I love things. This is definitely an on-topic show. Mm-hmm. We're deep on Atlantis rising and the mystery school Atlantis connection tonight. This is episode 40 of the X series, and where we study the X steganography in history and in secrecy through government programs. You can find our newsletter is available to you at darkjournalist.com. Sign up for it. Go to the site. Get involved in that sense. Make sure you're on target. And don't procrastinate and subscribe. Also, get behind the show. Do your best to support the efforts that we have and bring back the efforts that we're doing on the Bring Back the X series for 2019. The best way to do that is just subscribe to the show. We're keeping that discounted to all the way to the December 31st. So there's never been a better time to get on board. And you're going to get things coming up in 2019 that have to do with X dialogues. And there's a lot of experts now who are, having studied the X steganography I've presented over 40 episodes, are now willing to come forward and talk about them. So I'm going to offer those first to subscribers. And I'd like to continue the work out here for everybody. We're going to be working hard on this stuff. So this is the best time to do it. Get on board and get behind the show and our efforts in this regard. I definitely can see with the Atlantis rising aspects that the time is coming up where, you know, it's going to be interesting because a lot of collective effort is going to be required in order to move the culture aspect forward. And we can function pretty well as independent researchers and studying things in our own worlds. And it makes a big difference when we do. But I can see that it's, on certain levels, there's going to be collaboration necessary if anything important is going to come out of a lot of the incredible revelations that are coming up. So let's get together and collaborate on these things. Okay. Egerton Sykes, the expert on the ultimate Atlantis scholar, let's say. Quote, 1966. For years, I've been endeavoring to persuade people of the need for the exploration of the Caribbean area, as it has always seemed to me that if we could manage to establish a partial bridge over the gap separating the beginnings of culture in Central America before 300 BC and the establishment of the Mayan calendar some 8,500 years earlier, we should have gone a long way towards producing a concrete evidence of the existence of the Atlantean culture, which in its death throes gave birth to several flourishing cultures, including those which existed in Mexico until the arrival of the Spaniards, where our culture, you know, those cultures were so rudely interrupted by the vicious Spaniard conquerors. Back to Sykes. The key factor is the realization that the Maya who arrived on the mainland, complete with a knowledge of writing, mathematics, and of astronomy, of architecture of medicine and with a calendrical system, which was more accurate than that used in Europe until the 18th century. Let that sink in. The usual assumption that they picked up in 100 years or less the knowledge which it took the Western world 2,000 or more years to acquire seems to me to be unrelated either to historical precedent or to common sense. Excellent. We can see he's a real deep thinker. And he goes into some of the researchers he respects here, but I'm going to skip some of that fascinating stuff so I can get to this part. He does a lot of quoting of ancient stories and what they mean. But he goes on here and he talks about Mitchell Hedges, the explorer who spent many years investigating the Caribbean and was certain of the antiquity of its cultures. And he quotes a Dr. Mertz in relation to Mitchell Hedges. Quote, on Barbaret, he found a statue of a god about 4 feet high, cut out of rock crystal. He considered it to be a work of art which had taken centuries to finish. He also found a crystal skull, of which I have a photograph, which I consider to be finer than the one in the British Museum. Indeed, the Mitchell Hedges skull is the best of the crystal skulls. The reason why these objects were cut out of crystal, a most difficult task, is unknown. But a correspondence once suggested that the stories of a temple with transparent walls might be linked to the objects. There's been a certain amount of archaeological work done in Cuba and Bimini, which is of interest. The details are given below. Quote, Cuba. Although Cuba is the largest island in the West Indies, it is also the one least known about archaeologically. However, in 1951 and 1952, the Cuban Institute of Archaeology published a paper by Garcia Juarez, which translated into English by Robert Perez. As the text is a short one, it is given below. Quote, in 1952, the Cuban Institute of Archaeology was studying the subject of Atlantis. In 1952. And their attention was drawn to a report that your editor considered the traces of this culture might be found in Cuba and Santo Domingo and other West Indian islands. Of these, Cuba seemed the most suitable owing to its size. The most suitable site was Punta del Este. That's where I showed the spirals earlier. And the Island of Pines, where flights of steps were discovered leading from the prehistoric caves to a site on the promontory where there were traces of a rudimentary astronomical observatory, which might have been used by the priests for calculation of astronomical data. So they'd gotten pretty deep by 1952, and the government that was running Cuba was the Batista government, which was corrupt, but was in deep with the Americans. So the Americans kind of let them run it the way that they would, as long as they allowed them to be in there. When the revolution came, which was a surprise, apparently, to the deep state and to the Americans, such a surprise that they tried to infiltrate Castro's government to see what was going on there, and they still didn't get a handle on it. That revolution took them so by surprise that all their plans for what they were doing there in relation to these ruins and the things that were being discovered got thrown out. And they realized when Castro took over that now he was going to be the one in charge of that entire landmass and the area around it. So this became a huge problem for them. So the deep state aspect of the problem, that is that the deep state wanted to use Cuba as part of their dominance of the Western Hemisphere, doesn't add up in terms of the types of risks that were taken and the nukes and everything else that came about as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's something deeper. There's some piece of it, just like there's some piece with Hemingway and the Finca Vigia that doesn't make sense that it rises to this level of a national security crisis. So I think we have to look deeper. Certainly, the geopolitical reasons can be deep. But I think for the impact of it, now that we understand that they were looking for Atlantis almost 10, about 10 years earlier in Cuba, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, puts this entire thing in much better perspective. And this is what Sykes was getting at. But what's interesting to me is that Sykes decided that the best place to find Atlantis ruins would be Cuba and off Cuba. He was the one who was deep in there. And for him, I think to go in that direction is quite fascinating. He does a lot in here about the Bimini aspects and how when they discovered that wall, it fit in with the whole this whole idea of the Fountain of Youth and Ponce de Leon and so forth. So this is somebody who was giving us, I think, very rare material. I want to crisscross what Egerton Sykes just gave us with and that whole Cuban background with the conversation with Zelitsky that she gave. Now she spoke to a number of journalists, and I want to one of the great things is she spoke to some magazines, and I got some of what she got said to Linda Moulton Howe at the time, and our great friend Linda. And unfortunately, there was not a follow-up. But from some of these articles, I've collected these quotes here. So now Zelitsky, she studied engineering in the Soviet Union and oceanography and was assigned to work on a secret submarine base in Cuba during the Cold War. She eventually defected to Canada. She met her current husband, businessman Paul Zwanzig. Now, the couple own and operate a company called Advanced Digital Communications. And again, this is Paulina Zelitsky, who found the Cuban city there. So Zelitsky reports that at about 2,200 feet off Cuba's western tip, she's found a huge land plateau with clear images of what appear to be man-made large-size architectural designs, partly covered by sand. From above, the shapes resemble pyramids, roads, and buildings, quote unquote. Okay, so here's some of the QA that she's had with Linda and AP. Is there anything that you can say on the record this morning that I can do some kind of an update? For the record, you can say that the Center for Marine Archaeology and Anthropology at the Cuban Academy of Science is currently analyzing video data that we have from the perimeter of the site from megalithic stones. They're working on inscriptions that they have detected on the stones and are analyzing them at the time. What are the estimated size of these stones? The estimated size of these stones, they are roughly about 2 by 5 meters, very large stones. That's about 6 feet by 15 or 16 feet, something like that. 6 feet on each of the four sides and 16 feet high. So they go into a little bit about how the stones look like Stonehenge. On these stones, where are the possible inscriptions? They are not anywhere specific on the stones, these inscriptions. They could be in the middle of the stones, various parts of the stones across. One thing we found, the anthropologist found, was an American cross. It's a Central American cross. I found the references go here to X-steganography, and we'll see as we get along. Is that where two lines are crossed perpendicular to each other? No, they're not two lines. They're oval shapes crossing each other. Okay, so this goes on. There's a description there. And they talk a little bit about the process of getting down there. And so they get asked, have they made any comments, the people that the museum that's trying to analyze the carved inscriptions, have they made any comments about the symbols or carvings? And Zelitsky answers, Greek-like inscriptions. Greek-like? Well, hieroglyphic-like inscriptions. Hieroglyphic like Egypt? I said the lettering is Greek-like. Hold on just a minute. Why don't you talk to my boss? Okay, so Pauline Zelitsky goes forward here and she says, I'm so happy to meet you, so on. Okay, so they have another conversation. Now, this is a second interview. And so they try to clarify some things about, are these Greek inscriptions that you're seeing? And she says, no, I was overhearing, and I don't want you to make any bad mistakes mixing Greek. That was my husband's mistake. So the husband, apparently, in reports, had given these interviews saying that they look like Greek. And she says, no, because it's not Greek. It has the same tendency, but it's not Greek. We don't know what it is, and scientists are trying to decipher it. Right, it has some resemblance. This is the question now. It has some resemblance to the lettering of Greek, but it's not Greek. Are there some pictographs that would fall into the hieroglyphic category as well? Now, this is Zelitsky. Yes, and symbols as well. There are different signs, more like American nature, they have found in Central America. Pyramids, strong delineation of the structures which suggest pyramidal type. American pyramidal type, not Egyptian pyramidal type. So they're finding Mayan pyramids, not Egyptian classic Great Pyramids, that kind of thing. And she clarifies it and so on. Then she said, are the caves underwater around the island, is that where the American cross has been found carved? Yes, and other symbology, other cosmic type depictions. And you find this in Cuban caves around the island, not only in the north, but in the south. These caves are underwater caves. One of the cave I know of is on land and has this type of symbology as well. So they go off about the caves for a little bit. But what I wanted to really point out there is that she's giving us this impression of what these different symbols look like. And Zelitsky wanted to show the crossed oval symbol and the spirals. So the image is from the Cuban Isle of Youth and restored by archaeologists, but there are a number of similar Cuban caves. That is the cross that she's referring to that is showing up in the caves, but is also present there under the water and the ruins that she's seeing. And then here we have again, that is Zelitsky looking up at the ruins in the cave. So I think what's pretty clear from that is that Zelitsky is confirming for this much on the record that not only has she seen the pyramids and she's related sphinxes and Rhodes, now, and the sphinxes do sound more Greek Egyptian, of course, than the Mayans. But the pyramids are clearly Mayan, and the structures look Mayan or Central American. The hieroglyphs are definitely Central American Mayan variety. So when we think of it this way, this culture is that kind of Poseidonian culture that was there in Atlantis. When that sank, they were the ones who dispersed to the Inca and the Maya and that whole area. That's why it's so much more like that. But I think what she's confirming for us there on the record also is that she's seen some of the very same carvings and images like that cross and the spiral above ground in the caves as she's seen on the ruins below. That's crucial because it means that these two pieces were connected at one point. And I think what we're getting there is she's confirming on the record the extent of the ruins and the analysis that they were doing at the time, and that they had pictures that could go close up and look at inscriptions where you could actually identify things like hieroglyphics. So we've gone way beyond the stage of strange anomalies appearing in the water that might be a mound or might be whatever. She's looking at inscriptions. So in a way, the cat's already out of the bag. The question is, why are we in this strange twilight zone of radio silence about it? Now, the big story out of Cuba, these people with concussions. We're not getting anything about this story. But we do have this unusual story about Ernest Hemingway and the vault that was taken out of Cuba, presumably because he was looking for the same thing. So we can see that we're right at the very heart of this Atlantis Rising story. And it brings us into Zelitsky's work. It crisscrosses with what the Hemingways were after. And what, remember this also, that Les Hemingway is reported to be the first one to see those ruins and put them on the record. So he was flying over Cuba and saw it, basically identified it. Later, they get Zelitsky over there, and the Russians do this weird thing to get her over there. They pull a ruse that they need her to study ocean currents. And they're expecting she's going to be able to do this. And instead, she defects to Canada. And somehow, some 30 years after this defection, Castro welcomes her back to Cuba and has her as the lead team doing this oceanography work, finding these ruins, under the ruse that she's looking for pirate ships. So you can see this is a very deep, convoluted situation about Atlantis rising off of Cuba. And it all goes back to the thing that Edgar Cayce was telling us, which is that these ruins are on the rise, and it's something that you're going to see the first inklings of in this area of Bimini in 68. But apparently it's the whole region that's going to rise, and there will be land appearing off the East Coast. I believe that these movements are going to be undeniable at a certain point, and that this whole term about disclosure, it's going to be pretty obvious on the Atlantis side what we see, because it's going to be something where anyone who has the ability to look geographically underwater will see these things rising. And we know that there are people looking that are beyond just the nation states that are involved. So we've got a pretty dramatic situation unfolding there. And if we can get our handle on the Hemingway aspect of it and how that sparked this national security memo and how that put pressure on these families and how this whole process works, we're going to understand what the Atlantis Rising aspect is all about. And again, it goes back over and over again to the mystery school influence coming off of people like Steiner and Cayce informing the public this stuff's about to happen. And with that, Miss Olivia, I'm going to turn it back over to you, and I'm going to show everyone here the Andros platform, because I mentioned that. Oh, this is the island of Andros off there, and that's where we're finding that strange underwater anomaly, which I have to say looks just like the Bimini Road. I would say it's basically the same kind of thing. Okay, Miss Olivia.
Okay, so Justin Thomas wants to know, do you see Atlantean, post-Atlantean, Egyptian artifacts preservation part of JFK's push for disclosure of Atlantis rising as the unveiling of our true history? Do you follow all that?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that we're in this period where our perception of history can change. I don't see that it's a guaranteed thing, and I get worried when I hear people say, this stuff is changing and nobody can stop it. No, people can stop it. And that's the whole point about being vigilant, about seeing through to what the truth of it is, reporting it and getting that truth out and sharing that truth and getting deeper on it. It's not going to happen automatically on its own. I do feel like certainly a number of these things are in the air. And there's a little bit of the, you know, what they, that 100th monkey syndrome about it. Where in the collective unconscious, we all start to catch on. And I've said this a long time ago when it came to when people were talking about crash retrievals and military officials looking at crashed aliens and things like that. You know, this is a shared experience on a certain level, something like that. This kind of psychic link that takes place. We've seen it in the work of Jung, and we've seen it in people who've studied psychic work. Even remote viewing goes into some of this. You know, there is kind of a collective understanding. And so something like off-world civilizations visiting and people having viewed that, it kind of gets into our own consciousness, and we start to understand it pretty well. I do feel like there's a danger of, you know, I'm going to call it the like high-fiving aspect, where people, and you see this a lot in groups and communities saying like, hey, we took the government back. Everything's great. We're moving all the bad guys to Gitmo, which by the way is in Cuba. You know, no, there aren't, nobody's going to Gitmo. Nothing's been prepared at Gitmo, and there's no tribunals for anyone at Gitmo. It's never happened. It's like Cabal arrests. Those are nice fantasies. They don't happen that way. The only things that happen is that things get changed on the ground when enough people become aware and put the spotlight on something. Or once in a while we get lucky and maybe somebody, you know, in a high position messes up, as we've seen. But I do feel like this tendency for hope porn around that kind of thing, of these things just changing and us just having to show up, isn't really true. I think it's something you have to work at and succeed at. So I'd take maybe a little bit, I understand the premise of the question, and I would say that, you know, there is something, the opportunity is here, and that's the exciting thing, but I don't think it's a given. Okay.
Okay. David Tormina wants to know, DJ, do you think Putin spoke to Trump about Atlantis in Cuba?
Yes, I do. But I don't think that even Putin is giving away. Look, Putin loves to play his cards, and he's got, he may have even flexed muscle on that. I think that the two leaders there wanted to discuss some deep aspects, like this Atlantis story and like the UFO file aspects, and that there was extreme outrage that no one but an interpreter was there. They were just freaked out. The deep state wanted in on that conversation. And they were like, how dare you, you know, you're a traitor meeting with Putin and actually having a discussion. I mean, they try to do this. Look, Kennedy did the same thing. He didn't want any aides with him. He wanted just an interpreter. Reagan did the same thing. Let me talk with an interpreter to Gorbachev. They understand that the national security state apparatus likes to interfere, and fear is maybe the operative word. They like to really take it upon themselves to control the world. And when you get the two most powerful individuals in the world meeting, anything could happen. In fact, their whole position could be undercut. So therefore, they freak out and they try to prevent those things from happening by saying, oh, you're a traitor. How dare you? You're a puppet of Putin. But the Russians, according to Sykes, have the more robust Atlantis search program. So what does that tell us? It means that they're pretty far ahead of the game. And if anything, on the public side, we need to become very educated about the Atlantis Rising aspects, because it's been given to us as a legacy from the mystery schools, the knowledge of it. But now it's active in geopolitics. So we really have to understand what that is all about. And I do feel like the focal point, the lens maybe we can understand it through, is the Hemingway story.
Dan Anderson wanted to add that Russia has that new, awesome, powerful submarine, by the way, that the USA yes. cannot touch in any way.
Well, they have those Satan missiles. That's not a nice name for a missile that carries a nuke, no, is it? Yeah, I felt terrible when they were flexing their muscle like that. And I think it's easy, just as easy for Russia to be corrupt as it is for our own deep state. So hopefully, something better comes out of the future of what they're looking at on the nuclear side too. In terms of this story, I feel like Russia, Cuba, and America all have their hands on this, and to some degree China. But what's happening is that I think that Russia and Cuba are looking at getting together on it. And when Cuba invited the Americans in, that there was some force there that didn't want the Americans to make the deal with Cuba, and that they gave the Americans problems. Now, Joseph Farrell talks about a post-fascist international group, which we know is involved in setting up CERN and has very kind of moved into the corridors of power of some of these major national security powers. So they're a factor. We know that their last big hangout was Argentina. So there might be a South American aspect to this, but whatever it is, the more transparency we get on the idea, if it becomes common parlance for us to discuss the idea that land is rising off the east coast of America that is related to this Atlantis Rising prediction that the mystery schools made, then I think we have a better handle on the geopolitics that take place as a result.
Okay. Patricia Blue, is there an accurate timeline of Atlantis?
Well, the timeline that's given to us by the Casey readings is 200,000 BC to about 10,000 BC. So almost 200,000 years of culture there. And again, I want to stress, just like Steiner stressed and how Casey stressed that the bodies were different. And this is kind of an important thing to talk about, because the way that it worked is the bodies in Atlantis and in Egypt were much more ethereal. So they were operating more from their ethereal body. And so therefore, it's tough for us to understand that and how they had a much better interplay with nature and had a much better interplay with the kind of metaphysical aspect of lives, their spiritual aspect. When we look at it that way, we start to get the picture. And one of the things that Casey describes on this, and he says, the bodies back then were not so closely knit in matter. And Steiner would literally say, we would hover above these physical bodies in our ethereal bodies. So we weren't fully physical. I think that gives us a better idea about how Atlantis started and some of the early issues in the evolution of it. Apparently some things went wrong back there as a result of this. There's this idea about thought forms being projected. And when I read the story of Casey on Atlantis, he talks about these things, and he talks about how these soul spirits projected themselves into the animal kingdom and got trapped in those animal forms, one. But he also talks about the untouchables and how they were not given any purpose and they were trapped in there. And those, to me, sound like clones, like androids. It's very powerful work, and that's why I feel the Casey work is so pertinent, because although, you know, he died some 80 years ago, it's so advanced that we're just catching up to the kind of stuff he was giving us. So there's a description back there that we might have monkeyed around with the DNA for sure and created these basically kind of like slave robot type idea.
Okay, Christine Taggart, America, Russia, Cuba, Atlantis, and Mu. Will history repeat itself?
What an excellent question, Christine.
That is the question.
It is. Apparently, remember, the thing that's so interesting about the Casey readings is he said all these things were coming back into play so they could play themselves out again and this time not take the route that they took. However, they could recur the same way that they recurred. So there could be destruction in the future, or there could be passing the test and moving the culture forward, and the whole evolving of human consciousness could take place. This is really what's at stake. And, you know, it starts in small ways, really. I think about local organizers and people who do local politics, and then gets into larger politics, and then people making policy changes, and then, you know, corporations trying to turn people into slaves and forget about constitutions, and the Davos crowd moving in with transhumanism, and then the resistance on that side and people trying to go back to organize growing food locally. All these things they're intertwined. And if we can get a handle on the history of what we've been given that's come down to us on the mystery school side, we get a much better handle on where we are and when it comes to society. So we see the effects of these things are all interconnected. So, you know, when a company like Monsanto, for example, was doing all these things, you know, this is like they might as well be the Belial group in Atlantis all over again. And if we have that history, we might be able to identify them a little bit better. Let's put it that way. So that's the way I think we can really use the information. There's so much, exciting information, I think, in the Casey work and in anthroposophy, that when we come at it and we come back to the mystery schools through the X steganography, that they've left information for us there. They've left trails for us to follow. And they are real. I mean, they're easy to document if you spend the time with them. And we've done 40 episodes on them here. So obviously there's a lot of material available.
Okay. So I've got three questions that are linked. Okay. Terrestrial Goldfish says, when do you think Atlantis will rise?
Okay.
David Tormina says, do you think there's a technology planted there to make something rise up? And Cole Dossi says, is it possible that they are using CERN to try to move the time tables backwards, or alternate timeline to stop Atlantis from rising, we should have more Atlantis stuff by now, as per Casey.
I do feel that there's a relationship to the CERN technology and the technology that they had in Atlantean times. So I'm glad you brought that up. There is something here where somebody mentioned, did they have a device to raise Atlantis up? No, I think this is a natural geological occurrence. And this is how, you know, that precession works and that the mystery schools understand it. So they're pinpointing it for us, just like Casey in a reading state in 1943 can say, expect the first part of that temple to rise off Bimini in 1968. And then when they fly over Bimini, they find the Bimini Wall. Well, how would Bimini, you know, how would Casey be able to predict it 25 years out? Obviously, he has that vision. They understand in those mystery schools how precession works. So they can see geologically these things that are happening. So just like when they look at potential Earth changes that are coming up as a result of the position of the globe moving in relation to the cosmos, well, things will happen, of course, when land masses go down, other land masses come up. So this is a period, apparently, that we're entering here, where it's not just like the consciousness of Atlantis coming back, it is the actual land itself where these things took place. And I think that was the point that he was making. But it went down because of the misuse of these two-eye stones in such a dramatic fashion that it was kept for years and years in these mystery schools, the knowledge of how it happened, because that's where you get the ex-steganography holding that over that we've demonstrated. Because what they saw, basically, is that it was so devastating that it actually endangered the entire future of humanity. It wasn't just, I mean, it would be bad enough if they just let off their own nuke, but it was apparently this apotheum effect introduced a secondary physics, which was completely uncontrollable, and it's a reality distortion thing. So those groups, those mystery schools, decided we're going to keep this knowledge underground so that it doesn't happen again. So here we are rediscovering this technology. So it is a very crucial time, I think, for humanity. But yeah, great question.
Bo Creels wants to know if the melting of the ice caps, global warming, will prevent Atlantis from rising.
Well, you know, I don't think so. I don't think, I mean, I'm sure that the mystery schools had that in mind about what was going to happen. But I don't think, you know, obviously the environmental damage that's being done on a regular basis by the corporations is devastating. And the fact that they're trying to collect a carbon tax, you know, we saw how well that worked out in France from the populace for things that the corporations have done is absurd. And it's not going to fly. Look, there's another very interesting thing that Casey says in the readings. And he says, you know, if there's ever a full-scale revolution in America, it'll be because of the divisions between capital and labor. And if capital doesn't consider the position of labor, then they're going to invite a revolution. It's inevitable. I mean, we can see that there's a lot of that going on right now. And, you know, what they've done is they've outsourced so much of the labor to China. And how have they handled this? You know, well, they have these guys, they worked to death so hard in the Apple factories that they committed suicide. And so what did they do? They didn't get psychological things in there or work them any less. They put nets outside. So when they did jump out the window, they wouldn't die. This is the mentality of the slave masters. And the slave masters are embedded deep in the corporate structure. And they meet when they get together at the Davos, you know, that Davos event. It really is like a meeting of mob bosses, you know. They're going to do what they can to have this kind of dominance. And I think with the advent of things like the space fence, they're getting the ability to control and turn the Earth into a global control grid. So it's a puzzling situation that we've come to at this juncture. And I think it's going to require a lot of transparency on the ground and a lot of accountability, which, you know, I'm actually hopeful we can get some of that.
Okay. Well, now is certainly the time, because with AI and 5G and robots, which always makes you sound crazy when you say it.
You don't want a robot bartender?
Redundant and unnecessary. Yeah. And we have to realize that very quickly.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because on one hand, we have to deal with improving ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And certainly there's a lot of things that go on in human culture that are problematic. But how would you like to, you know, just turn that, all of those kind of undeveloped human impulses over to robots that have like no conscience and nothing? That seems to me, you know, the problem with most of the technology is that it is grown faster than the character of the people using it. And this mm-hmm. was the disaster in Atlantis. And we're heading into that scenario now. It's so obvious, you know, what was it? We were talking about the Terminator movies mm-hmm. and how the Terminator movies are a perfect description of what's taking place in like Amazon factories right now. And, you know, how they want to use, they have these incredible robots moving this stuff around and they ship the jobs out and all the rest of it.
Their advancement is exponential. You guys have to understand that, you know, Harvard is down the street. We've got MIT, we have Tufts, we have all these great schools here. And every year there's a batch of new students that graduate and they go and they're brilliant and they go out into the world and they get hired yes. by these places. You know, they're just using their minds. They're fairly innocent, I think, about what they're, you know, they think, oh, it's wonderful they're creating all these robots. But, yeah, you know, absolutely. They don't know what they're participating in. When I see these graduation ceremonies, I cringe.
Right, right. Well, the automation and the robotics become, it's inevitable on one hand, but if it's not handled, that is, if we don't keep the upper hand on it, you know, it's going to be absurd. And the corporations are going to insist upon it because of their bottom line and because it makes their lives easier because they don't have to deal with pesky things like labor laws, for example. So there's a big problem, a major, major problem brewing there. And I think that what we saw in France actually gives us a hint of what's under the surface, and it's not pretty. So, yeah, I think that those guys are drunk with power right now, and it's a bad scene. Just like Google and the social media companies are, look, they might end up breaking these companies apart, you know, because they are monopolistic. So, you know, I say that right in the middle of it, knowing how much that Google controls, how much Facebook controls, you know, they have to kind of, the public has to be aware of what they're up to, one, and they have to be accountable to the public. If you lose that relationship with a corporation, it's a dangerous situation. And meanwhile, they have people over here fantasizing that they have all, you know, Hillary's going to Gitmo and all that stuff. And it's great, right? They're wasting all this energy thinking these things that are fantasies, you know.
They're wasting tremendous energy.
Yeah, and you have a real threat mm-hmm. on your radar, and you're worried about JFK Jr. I mean, mm-hmm. come on, you know. I mean, you are making the case for them, right? So you have to ask yourself at the end of the day, I think there is a way to turn this kind of thing around, but it requires a perspective that is found in the alternative research field, which is that there's something deeper going on and that we need to get a handle on it in order to live a free and inspired life, as it were. But yeah, if the robot bartender in the driver's car bother you, you know, wait till they get really deep with the robot stuff.
Right. There was that amazing episode of the reboot of the X-Files that everybody should see. It's just as good as the old sushi chef.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, what did Fitz say anything about it?
No, okay. But it is. It's quite good.
Oh man, it's terrifying. Yeah, it's in a funny way. It is so dystopian.
We should find the title of that.
Yeah,
that
we
is
should.
A fantastic
it's
episode.
It's great.
But so, basically, there's a runaway robot sushi chef who's coming after Mulder and Scully. And yeah, that's
right.
A great
and
one.
The driverless cars and all of that.
Yes.
Yeah, everything is automated. So if the machines turn against you, it's like a Twilight Zone episode. You know, you're screwed.
It's all because you didn't give him a tip.
Yes. and like a star rating also, like a good review.
I can't give you I'll tell you this, which is that there's going to be a lot of transhumanism in the coverage coming up in 2019, and there's a good reason for it. And there's going to be something particularly explosive that we're going to present in January. around that. So, but yeah, we're on top of it. There's no good that we're in the season, you know, where it's the time has come. Okay. We'll take a couple more questions.
Okay. So Esoteric 369 Wall wants to know if Hemingway ever met Ed Leed Skelton.
Isn't that interesting? Well, they both were in the same neck of the woods because down in the Keys, but I don't have anything about him meeting Skelton because what's interesting about Eddie Leed Skelton, who built Coral Castle, he wasn't a well-known person. And but wouldn't it be a fascinating thing if there were a record? I mean, it would be interesting to think of if Hemingway had heard about Coral Castle or not, since he was down in the Keys so much. But right off the bat, no. But thanks very much for the question.
Okay, so have you actually... I don't actually know the answer to this. Have you done any FOIA requests for Hemingway or Sykes?
Yes, I have a very robust program around those things, but until I have them, I don't discuss them.
Okay.
That's the nature of the beast because of the type of material that I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I appreciate the idea that we need the fundamental records, and there are a lot of resources now, I think. We've done that certainly around the JFK case, and we came up with a lot of interesting material in relation to it. I want to remind everyone that you're watching Dark Journalist. This is episode 40 that we've been going through the search for Atlantis and the Mystery School connection to Cuba. And we've been doing this Hemingway series and the tie-in of the extraordinary dance of the Hemingway family with this Atlantis material that involves Edgar Casey's predictions about Atlantis rising off Bimini. And Les Hemingway founding the New Atlantis. There's a lot more in the story to come. And of course, Paulina Zelitsky's discovery of a city off Cuba, all these things come into focus. So we're going to take a couple more questions. And we're also going to tell you that we're coming back. The next live show is going to be on New Year's Day. I think that's Tuesday. Tuesday, January 1st is when our next live show is going to be. So everyone is going to have a fantastic holiday season until we see you again also. And I do want to recommend everyone sign up for the newsletter on the website, darkjournalist.com. Just go there and click on newsletter. That'll keep you updated on all the shows that are coming up and all the exciting material we have for you. And also subscribe at the site now, because up until December 31st, we're going to give you that discount. And you're going to want to be a subscriber now, because now is the time, too, because the material that's going to be around the X series, you're going to want those X dialogues and some of the things that we're going to give to you as members. And we're going to do as much, we don't do things like run commercials on these videos. It's important for me to keep it away from that type of influence. So,
no underwater. I'm reading something else. No underwear ads. No underwear ads. That's our policy.
My feeling is that we've been able to keep the platform really clear in terms of getting the programs to you. And you guys can get behind the show. This is the time really to do it. And the best way to do that is just to subscribe to the show. You can contribute to it and, really get in that line and bring back the X series for 2019. We have so much information and material for you guys coming up. And it really, we're on that stage where together here, we're looking at changing history, and it's going to shake things up quite a bit. And I don't say that lightly. And, I'm not somebody who brags about material at all. I just, what I feel like, we're getting such powerful information, and we have such powerful, great people working with us on it. And sometimes, when you look out there and you say, my God, we've got Gigi Young working with us, and, we've got great work done with Catherine Austin Fitz, and we're working with people like Fitz and Joseph Farrell to bring about the real dialogue about the types of things and how important it is to get a handle on the world as it is right now and the world that we're dealing with. I think there's incredible value in that for us. And I'm seeing signs in the alternative research field, in the space, in independent media, that something is happening that is turning more toward the deep material, something that we can use and something that will inspire us and away from the junk conspiracy. And that is something that I think you guys are helping to turn. So let's keep that going on. We'll take a couple more questions and then we'll sign off. Go for it.
Brian Lau wants to know, why did the ancients build megaliths in the first place?
Well, there's a lot of very interesting theories about that. Fundamentally, stone, just like with the pyramids, represents something on Earth in terms of our consciousness. Where those megaliths were placed, the type of stone that is used, and the different type of shapes that were chosen for it are all part of a developmental process that takes place in spiritual evolution. So those groups that knew about this in the mystery schools, who were initiates, they oversaw that process, and they knew when you walked into a particular temple or a particular cathedral or in a stone circle, it would actually impact and change your consciousness. Of course, they have great correlations to the cosmos and also to the magnetic lines running underground. And we're going to do a show about those ley lines, because one of the interesting things about Sykes is that he was the heir to the old straight track Alfred Watkins material, and he studied that quite a bit, and he found that the search for Atlantis was the search for the old straight track, which was the search for those ley lines and those magnetic lines. And along those ley lines, we find these incredible structures or the standing stones or things like the pyramids. And when you get around those, your consciousness is lifted. And that's, I think, one of the great secrets of the mystery schools, which is that there is what you would call sacred architecture and the whole geomancy. That is a field and a whole school of thought and vibration that these mystery schools know how to use quite well. Okay,
Enki is just dying to have me ask you. Pretty, please ask. DJ, what is the Ark of Gabriel? Why did they take it to Antarctica? And was it the key to Atlantis remnants there? Did Casey ever mention it?
No, I'm not. I don't see. There's some of these things get into urban legends too, so we have to be careful. For example, the Ark of the Covenant is something that definitely existed, and we know about it, and it had incredible powers.
I'm sure it still exists somewhere.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is how they left directions for it to be rebuilt. There's a lot of weird things going on in Antarctica, and there has to be a way to get some good, solid information on the ground. We do know a few things about it, which is that they had extraordinary visitors over the past couple of years, including astronauts and secretaries of state and all the rest of it. So I do feel that it's worthy of us to get deep on it. But I'm also, you have to be very careful about the junk conspiracy aspect coming out of that. You know, like they ran this picture for a long time, and I was almost going to print it out for tonight, but they've been running this picture of this pyramid covered in ice and saying it's in Antarctica and all that. And there's just no proof for it, you know, at all. So what we do have, for example, with the underwater ruins, is we do have real pictures of the Bimini Wall. We do have real pictures of the underwater city of Cuba. So, you know, I think we should go more in that direction, and we should keep our eyes open on the Antarctica situation and look for some real evidence. But unfortunately, right now, we don't have evidence that they're looking at ancient structures there. This is interesting. I forgot to show those. Maybe we'll end on this. This is one of those platforms nearby to where Casey said these firestones were. But this is actually somewhere in Piedras Negras, near Guatemala. And clearly, in this very interesting area and what Casey called platforms, it looks very much like they're observing some technological aspect arising out of this box. I found this image very interesting, especially since it was close by to where Casey said the Yucatan Hall of Records would be. So we're looking at something very, very unusual in some of these inscriptions. I think a deeper study of the inscriptions of Yucatan in relation to the Casey information would be a great idea. And with that, I am going to say that we will see you guys on New Year's Day. We're going to have a very exciting episode for you then. It's so great to have everyone out there. It's been terrific to see everyone tonight. It's a huge crowd for episode 40 of the X series. And, you know, of course, over the course of these some 44 weeks, because we've done double up episodes also whenever we've come to the end. So we did 4 to 3 regular episodes along with the intro, which gives us 44 to end the year with. But there is something there, which I think the material, now we have a foundation to move forward that we didn't have before. That's the gift of the X-Steganography and all of us working together to get on that research, to bring in the knowledge of the mystery schools, to bring in the knowledge of the stealth archives, to bring in the knowledge of the UFO file and the apothium that's caused this wall of secrecy and how that gets into the geopolitical aspects. We're close. We're close now. We're a lot closer than we were than we started the show. And this is a great thing. And a lot of that is thanks to you guys. So I really appreciate all the things that you've sent us and all the support certainly has been great. And we're only going to go deeper at this point. And I can guarantee you we're going to start the new year off with a bang. So Miss Olivia, you get the last word.
Well, do you have any recommended reading for people who may have some time off over the holidays, particularly on the Atlantis subject?
No question. Well, I'm going to put out a list, actually, because I'm going to do a top 10 list in relation to the show itself. But I will say, of course, that Edgar Casey on Atlantis is required reading. And then A Cosmic Memory, Atlantis and Lemuria by Rudolf Steiner. If you want to understand the subject, those are two pillars. They're kind of foundations of it. I think that, you know, we start to go deep. Ignatius Donnelly in the Antediluvian World gives us this incredible breakthrough that was happening in the 19th century, given the fact that we're 140 years out from that, then, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that we know now that he didn't know then. But I think that those are good, really excellent foundation books. And really, I also feel that the lectures that in anthroposophy that Rudolf Steiner gave on Lucifer and Ahriman are very crucial to the 21st century and this period that we're in right now. And I highly recommend them. And I also feel that in terms of Atlantis, the work of Graham Hancock, of course, Magicians of the Gods, and his older work from the 90s, Fingerprints of the Gods, you know, those are great foundational studies.
You know, I would say also, I'll speak for myself, I think that we're all getting activated and we have access to...
Activated access.
Yeah, well, we have access to soul memory that maybe we didn't have years ago. So going back and watching things that had an impact on us back then may be revelatory now. We may get more insights.
I absolutely agree. I think revisiting material is crucial. That's absolutely crucial. And I've enjoyed the work in the past of people like Charles Berlitz and Dr. David Zink when they were researching this and they were going really hardcore on Atlantis. And that's really older material now from the 80s. But I think that they were making great strides in looking at that. So, I think that generally, you know, the theosophical, anthroposophical material along with the Casey work provides the structure, provides the foundation, and then you find other things, you know, filling out that picture, basically, or you find more updated things fulfilling some of the things that they were talking about. But I do feel that if we can keep the idea and the thought of the mystery schools close, and I will close out episode 40 with Annie Besant doing the X ceremony here with Colonel Henry Alcott to the crucial members of the Theosophical Society, bringing about a better society and actually giving India home rule They weren't just dreamers. They were making things happen on the ground. And I think they're a great lesson to us, and that we need to be the same way, and that so much of the information that has come through Edgar Cayce and the Cayce work has been crucial in our understanding of Atlantis, and how we need to really get a handle on the fact that the mystery school information and this past that humanity has had is far more revelatory, is far more fantastic, is far more majestic than anything we've been fed in you know, the very trite archaeological and scientific publications on the matter. They've missed it completely. So let's see if we can give them a run for their money and show them what really is going on. And with that, I want everyone to have a fantastic night. Thank you so much for joining us. And Miss Olivia, the only question left is?
I guess it's why not? End the year on a pizza note.
Pizza note. Pizza's good. Pizza's good. Saturday night pizza. You can't beat mm-hmm. that. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm going to do a quick shout out. David Donaway, a cult fan. Fantastic. Wow. Bo Krills, you did a great job out there. Great questions. My Soul on Fire, asking terrific stuff. And also, let's see who else we got. Christine Taggart, excellent. Fantastic. Yes. Merry Christmas to everyone. I hope the holidays go quite well.
We have some special shout outs to Chuck.
Yes, Chuck, the fantastic holiday music.
Mm-hmm. To Neil and to Jeanette and to Michelle, who were extremely generous.
Yes, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for everything you do to support the show and the efforts that we're making to bring some of this ex-steganography to light. I think it's going quite well right now. We will see you all on New Year's Day. And thank you, Brandon. And thank you, Lee Veltman. He's out there.
Yep.
Lee, the man.
The man.
Thank you, Carly, mm-hmm. Dimensions and Beyond. Fantastic job out there tonight. I can't wait to catch up with mm-hmm. you. And I know we saw Gigi out there. We're going to have her back, hopefully, for New Year's Day. Mm-hmm. Najat, terrific to see you. And we will see everyone. Sam Raven, haven't seen you mm-hmm. in a while. Excellent. The gang's all here. That's how we look at it. Thanks so much, guys. We love you. And we'll see you January 1st.
Yes. Thank you. Have a wonderful holiday.
Have a great one.